Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, hello and welcome along to Unbelievable. It's Saturday afternoon. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half up till 4 o'clock when Dave and Bea take over with Hip Rock UK. But between now and then, we've got some fascinating discussion for you as Christians and non-Christians come together as usual here in my studio to debate aspects of faith and belief. Well, I'll introduce my guests and the topic in just a moment's time. Just a quick reminder, though, that if you would like to get hold of it, the DVD for Unbelievable, the Conference 2012, which took place just over a month ago, is about to hit doormats pretty soon. So if you want to pre-order and get your copy arriving as soon as it possibly can, then do go to the website premier.org.uk/DVD. 6 speakers, 10 hours of material, 3 DVDs worth of stuff. Lots of Q&A, some extra features as well. It's well worth getting your hands on. People like Professor John Lennox, Krish Kandaya, Bonnie Yule Kuhn, our guests from Reasons to Believe in the States, Hugh Ross and Ken Samples on there. Michael Green, someone with a lifetime's experience in evangelism and apologetics. So much material, and you really won't regret getting hold of that. Watching it for yourself, perhaps you could use it in a house church context, a small group context, something like that. Fantastic seminars that we had on evangelism and apologetics, defense of the Christian faith. Do check it out, premier.org.uk/DVD. Well, let's find out what's coming up on today's program. You're unbelievable. Well, joining me on the show today, two very special guests, Oz Guinness and Terry Sanderson. Oz Guinness, my Christian guest today, as we ask the question, making a fair society, can Christians and secularists work together so everyone gets heard? Oz is an author, a social critic. He recently presented the Global Charter of Conscience at a lecture for Premier Media Group. And you can actually hear that tomorrow evening at 9 p.m. That's Sunday, the 1st of July. The charter is aimed at addressing the urgent problems raised of living with our deepest differences. We'll be getting into that in a moment with Oz. And in conversation with Oz today, Terry Sanderson, my atheist guest. Terry, a leading UK secularist and president of the National Secular Society, which of course campaigns to promote secularism and challenge religious privilege. Gentlemen, thank you both for being with me today.
Real pleasure. Thank you, Justin.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Terry, for joining us. Let's start off with yourself, Oz. You've been on a little while back talking to the Baroness Warnock in the House of Lords. Not a dissimilar topic we were talking about at the time then, how in society we can get along together and ensure that all points of view are heard. But take us a little bit back to where this all began for you. You're a Christian and you've obviously been convinced of the truth of Christianity a long time. At what point did you start to realise that there was a lot of work to be done in helping people who have genuine points of difference on their religious views, their worldviews, in helping them actually get along and live together with those?
Well, I've been involved in religious freedom issues for about 30-odd years. Put simply, one of the deep problems of our world is how we live with our deep differences when those differences are religious and ideological. So in some countries, like, say, China, you have overt oppression. In other countries, like, say, Nigeria, you have very severe sectarian violence. And here in the West, and certainly in Britain and in America, we have mounting clashes that amount to a kind of culture wars. And at the end of the day, the bitterness deepens, the polarization stretch. So what we've done is a vision of a new way forward that is in the interest of people of all faiths and no faith. And so when this was launched in Brussels at the European Parliament, one of the people there was a UN rapporteur on religious freedom who gave a passionate endorsement from a secularist perspective. So this is not an argument between Christians and atheists or Christians and Muslims, anything like that. This is in the interests of the common good. And the question is, how can we each be faithful to what we believe and be true to that, and yet know how to deal with other people who are very different in ways that are civil?
We will always fight for the thing that we are attached to. You're not asking people to stop being like that when it comes to having
a dialogue. Let me be absolutely clear. This is not an interfaith dialogue. In other words, the goal of that is to so be loving, nice, civil to each other that you reach a kumbaya moment where you think you all agree in the same things. That's not true. I mean, I'm delighted to meet Terry by phone. I hope we'll meet in person. He is a secularist. I'm a Christian. People behind this include Jewish thinkers, gay thinkers, many people of different persuasions. We have our opinions and we're convinced of them. The point is, how do we deal with other people as citizens civilly? That's the point. So this allows us, unlike interfaith dialogue, there's no pretense we'll ever agree. We will disagree because differences are irreducible and ultimate. I mean, Terry may scorn people who believe, for all I know. Certainly Richard Dawkins does, and Sam Harris does, and the late lamented Christopher Hitchens did. You know, but that doesn't matter. The question is, when we're in public life together, are we going to go for the jugular and fight each other in ways that get ugly and extremist, as so often happens today? Or do we know how to debate and persuade with a civility, convinced of our own position, and trying to persuade other people, too, of the issues that matter to us?
Having lived a long time out in the States, how has that experience informed what you're bringing to the UK?
Very much in the positive and the negative, because, you know, James Madison called their settlement the true remedy. And for 200-odd years, with some egregious violations, they did a very good job, probably the most nearly perfect way of handling it. But in the last 50 years, since the early school prayer cases, they have had an increasingly ugly culture wars. And I'm ashamed to say that many of my fellow Christians have been part of the problem in America. So I've learned from the best of America, but also from the worst. And I have to say bluntly, many people in the young millennial generation are dropping out of the faith altogether because they're put off by the ugly extremism, the sub-Christian tactics of the so-called Christian right. So I've learned from the worst as well as the best.
Well, joining us for this discussion, as I mentioned, is Terry Sanderson of the National Secular Society. Terry, thank you very much for coming on the programme today.
Glad to be here.
Terry, give us a little background to the National Secular Society for those who are not familiar. When has that been going since exactly?
Well, it was founded in 1866 by a man called Charles Bradlaugh, who was a sort of self-educated man who had an ambition to be a lawyer, but he came from a very deprived background in Victorian times. But
I think he came from my hometown of Northampton, if I'm not correct.
Or he was actually MP for that.
MP there, yes.
Yeah, he was born in Hoxton in London. And he educated himself and became very prominent in the movement to restrict the Church of England's influence in society, because at that time the Church of England more or less ran the country. If you weren't a member of the Church of England, you couldn't go to university, you couldn't be a member of Parliament, that kind of thing. So he thought that needed to be changed, and so that's why he tried to enter Parliament eventually. And he was elected for Northampton, but turned away four times from Parliament because he couldn't, in conscience, swear a religious oath, and that was absolutely the law at that stage. But eventually the Speaker said, after he'd been re-elected four times, look, all right, you can swear, cross your fingers behind your back or something. And so he did eventually enter Parliament. But he was a very committed atheist. Secularism now has taken on a very different sort of definition and meaning. But at that time, he was an atheist and thought that atheism was the answer to that. But ideas have developed since then. And I'm now the president of the National Secular Society, and my idea of secularism is very different to his. I'm not Richard Dawkins, and I'm not Christopher Hitchens. I'm a secularist first, and that is a political construct. It is not a sort of theology or a sort of...
Or an anti-theology. I mean, obviously, not everyone necessarily sees it that way, and I know plenty of people, perhaps wrongly, do associate secularism immediately with a worldview that excludes God. But are you saying that there are people who join the National Secular Society who are Christians, who are of other faiths?
Well, I would expect they do. I mean, I don't know. We don't ask people what their religion is. But if it's quite possible to be a Christian secularist. In fact, America, as we've just heard, has a secular constitution. And so, in some senses, all Americans are secularists because they live under that constitution and obey it. Well, so, you know, I mean...
It depends on the definitions, yeah, I suppose, doesn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly, exactly. This does. Is one of the problems, and one of the problems with this Charter of Conscience that Oz has been promoting, in that there does seem to be some confusion about what secularism means. It's often used interchangeably as atheist, and I find that very frustrating.
Well, let's talk about it then. And by the way, before we get into this discussion, if you're listening and you'd like to contribute, you'd like to have your say, don't forget you can always email in. I'm pleased to read those out at the end of every show. We'll be doing that today. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Again, that's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. The number as well, if you want to leave a voicemail message, 08456 52 52 52, and select the option for Unbelievable and the voicemail. Don't forget, we're online, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, and you can find links there to our Twitter and Facebook account and all the rest of it. So do follow us online, premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So we're asking on the programme today, making a fair society, can Christians and secularists work together so everyone gets heard? And Oz Guinness is with me here in the studio, and we're also joined by Terry Sanderson of the National Secular Society. Oz, your Global Charter of Conscience you presented in a lecture earlier on this week, and if you want to hear that, you can listen in at 9 o'clock tomorrow evening to Premier Christian Radio. Perhaps before we start hearing Terry commenting on it, give us, as it were, what this boils down to in terms of a nutshell of what you're trying to achieve in it, what suggestions you make as to how we can live with our deepest differences.
Well, let me make clear, this is nothing new in one sense. It's a reaffirmation and a wholehearted endorsement of Article 18 of the Universal Declaration, which is magnificently clear. But Article 18 has become the most contested, the most embattled of all the rights. And you can see in many of the culture warring clashes, its visions of how religion, ideology, worldviews can engage public life. Can they at all? And I think, for example, take in Europe. This is one great thing. Jürgen Habermas, one of the most famous European atheists and a pronounced atheist, would say that to exclude religious voices in the public square is highly illiberal. And that's the sort of position that the Charter takes, that everyone, whatever their ultimate belief, whatever their worldview, and I fully recognize, you know, I disagree with Richard Dawkins, and I'm glad Terry does too in some ways, but that is his right to believe his much more radical and somewhat extremist, even by fellow atheists called a fundamentalist atheism. He has every right to believe that, and on the basis of freedom of conscience, to enter the public square and argue his positions.
As he does.
And as he does. But so also do Jews, Scientologists, Mormons, Muslims, Christians, Hindus, and so on. In other words, the Charter is a vision of an open, free public square. Everyone has the right to engage, but with an understanding of how to respect other people's rights too. That's the key notion.
Okay, so this is the key thing. It's how we actually come to the table and discuss and understand another person's right to express themselves. Okay, well, what were your concerns then? You started out there, Terry, saying that you're not certain that Oz necessarily always means the same thing as you do by secularism. Is that what I understand?
Yes, I think sometimes it's used interchangeably, as I said, with atheism. And it's not about atheism. It really is about achieving what Oz's charter wants to achieve. That is to say, a free space that's open to everybody, but on equal terms. And I think that, you know, the secularism in the American Constitution in its purest form is very good. And also I like the French version too, although it's very different. And I'm sure Oz would call it excluding, because it doesn't sort of say all religions have an equal say in the state. It actually says the state and religion are separate, and they have their own domains.
Well, so, Terry, the American one is somewhat different. I mean, it disestablished religion, but it never separated faith and public life and the freedom of all faiths, whereas French laïcité had a different motive, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you look at, say, you know, Diderot's idea, we want to strangle the last king with the guts of the last priest. You had, and let's be quite blunt about it, you had a very corrupt church, a very corrupt state, and both were repressive. So the French radicals wanted to throw out both. So yeah, that separation is much more radical and excludes many voices today, and that's unfortunate. I like the way you put it earlier. You said entering freely on equal terms. That's what this charter's about. And the American one, at its best, not its current culture warring, at its best, the American one comes closest to that.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think that it has a lot to be said for it. One of the things that alarms me a little bit about your charter is that it does put an awful lot of emphasis on religious freedom. And in the West, there are an awful lot of people who are losing their religion, not because of apathy or anything like that. It's because they've actually made a conscious decision to walk away from it or to abandon organized religion and follow their own spirituality.
Absolutely,
in a way that's
Terry,
right for them.
But don't give the impression they're not covered too. The first article says quite clearly, you know, that it includes ultimate beliefs, naturalistic or religious, supernatural or, you know, transcendent or naturalistic.
Yeah.
It explicitly represents them too. So there's no suggestion that anyone who has a atheist, agnostic, secularist, you name whatever word you like, is in any way not included. It is
no,
everyone.
I'm sure they are. But the other thing that alarmed me a little bit was a redefinition of human rights to include group rights, when you said that people in community should have rights to have the same rights. That's when it starts to get difficult, because that's when organized religions begin to assert their superiority, and that's when the conflict begins. So I think you can't say that human rights can be extended to groups. Human rights are for human beings, individuals, for groups.
Well, actually, I think you're putting it rather simplistically. The charter has associative rights that are group rights and individual rights, because actually no human believes anything alone, or at least a few do, but not very many. And so the charter is absolutely clear that the individual, if he's coerced by the group, the individual rights trump the group rights. But there are many of the violations. Say, American universities now would say that any group that has a specific content to their commitments of leadership. So Vanderbilt University recently said that no Christian group could say that allegiance to Jesus could be stated as a criterion of being a leader. Well, that's absurd. They had no right to enter into that. So there are, very importantly, certain group rights. Now, the individual rights trump those group rights, and the charter is actually quite clear on that.
Yeah, I still don't think that it does the charter any favour to include that concept of group rights, because when you only have to look at the history of the world, the human race, and the way it's organised itself into religions to see that almost instantly that a religion is formed, it comes into conflict and as a body, not as a group of individuals. And I think, you know,
but you're only stating one side of it, Terry. You're absolutely right. The groups, in the name of either identity or truth, are often coercive of individuals, and that's terrible. And the Charter expressly speaks against that. But a balanced view, and actually you find many of the more recent conventions have a more balanced view, there are associative rights as well as individual rights, and you're not recognizing that. And that's an important point, because some of the other parts of the world say if you only have individual rights, you're creating an individualistic society that's Western and entitlement-oriented and so on, and that simply doesn't reflect human need for community as well as individual personhood. So I think the Charter is much more in line with current thinking.
I mean, it would be really useful, I think, to bring into play an example, you know, and we've got plenty to hand. This is really the point is that this is being brought forward, I think, Oz, because many Christians, perhaps, on the one hand, feel a little bit embattled in some way that maybe their voice isn't being heard in the way that they feel it should be. Perhaps on the other side, Terry and those who are involved with secularism feel that the religions have too much of a voice. And so this is a way of bringing them together and saying, how can we make sure that that is the case, that everyone has this equal voice? Now, here's an example. The B&B owners who were prosecuted for not allowing two gay men to share a bedroom they said that applied to anyone who was unmarried in their case, but obviously many people felt that this was just discriminatory. Now, is this a typical case of religious people being against the equal rights of other people? Where do we draw the line between the equal treatment and the right of Christians to practice their faith in good conscience? Mm-hmm. How would your charter help those two groups in that instance to come together
and establish? Only indirectly, because as the gay activists themselves recognize, gay rights is claimed as a civil right, not as a religious freedom right. So you have a clash of rights here. Now, the principal point behind this, you can trace it all the way back to a great pioneer like, say, Roger Williams in the 17th century, who pointed out that things go wrong, as in his words, and he's talking about the ship of state. He says those who are under the hatches, in other words, repressed, behave differently when they're at the helm. And his complaint was against Presbyterians in his day, who were as repressive of dissidents as the priests were in Catholic days. Mm. Now, you have a trouble today, say, in parts of the world, in the liberal world, gay rights are now the favored right. And so in America, often gay activists, and I have gay friends who disagree with this themselves, gay activists say, our new civil right trumps all other rights in a zero-sum game. I'm quoting a woman in the White House. Now, whenever rights clash, they need to be negotiated. It's never one right trumps another right. And that's the problem here, that a lot of thoughtlessness, people who don't understand rights and the whole discussion of freedom, just come in the name of some new right and overrule all others. There's a very serious point at this.
Where did the rights in that case, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, Terry, where did they come down as far as you're concerned? Whose rights were being transgressed?
I think that if you say that homosexuals only have civil rights and they don't have human rights, then you're in trouble.
No, I didn't say that. I didn't.
Terry,
you've got to be quote what I said.
Yeah, okay. You said no, homosexuals have civil rights.
Every human has human rights.
Okay, including homosexuals.
Terry. We don't have to get into that. We don't have to say things like every single human has human rights.
Okay.
Of course,
well,
there's no one at any level excluded. No one.
Well, human rights, as far as I'm concerned, always trump religious rights. Always. So if a homosexual has human rights...
Let's allow you to finish that, Terry.
If a homosexual has human rights, then he has the right to enjoy all the freedoms that everybody else in the country has. And we as a nation had a long debate about whether we would remove legal discrimination against homosexuals. And we decided in the end that we would. And we enshrined it in law. And suddenly these Christians said, well, we don't like that law. We're not going to obey it. And so when the two clashed, the courts found in favor of the law. And I think, you know, that to say that there is a clash of rights which have to be negotiated can only result in one thing, and that is the taking away of the human rights of those gay people.
Well, let me be absolutely clear. Every human has human rights. That's by definition. That's incredibly important. But religious freedom, properly understood, is actually the first. It was the first historically, and in many ways it's the first logically. If you take the three core rights, freedom of conscience, freedom of speech or expression, and freedom of assembly or association, freedom of assembly assumes and requires freedom of speech. You only want to get together with people you want to talk to about something serious. Freedom of speech assumes and requires freedom of conscience. You want to speak out upon something that you believe passionately based on the dictates of conscience. So religious freedom, and it's understood, let me be clear again, Terry, it's freedom, as the European conventions say, freedom of religion or belief. In other words, it includes secularist faiths from agnosticism right up to atheism. It is a fundamental human right. It's not the human rights trump religious freedom. Religious freedom is the first and in many ways the deepest of the human rights.
I would like you to define for me what you mean when you say religious freedom. Just tell me what you mean.
Well, just read the first article. I haven't got it right in front of me, Terry. Justin,
do you want to have the first article here?
Freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, which together may be described as religious freedom, is a precious, fundamental, and inalienable human right, the right to adopt, hold, freely exercise, share, or change, that's against Muslim apostasy, or change one's beliefs, subject solely to the dictates of conscience and independent of all outside, especially governmental, control. This freedom, and here's the point addressing what we were talking about earlier, this freedom includes all ultimate beliefs and worldviews, whether supernatural or secular, transcendent or naturalistic. That's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about religious freedom, and it certainly includes you.
Well, I still don't understand how far this religious freedom extends, because obviously with the culture wars that are going on in America and to an extent here, we have people who have very different understandings about how far their freedom of religion extends into other people's lives. And I think this is where the problems begin.
We'll take a quick break there, Terry, because we're already nearing the end of our first part. And with that in mind, and where these where do they overstep other people's human rights to live their life unimpeded? We're going to come back to that in just a moment's time. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, as we ask today, making a fair society, can Christians and secularists work together so everyone gets heard? There's a proposal on the table called the Global Charter of Conscience, presented by Os Guinness recently, both in Brussels and more recently here in the UK in a recent lecture hosted by Premier Christian Radio. So that'll be available for you to listen to tomorrow night on Premier Radio at 9 p.m. It's also online on our website, premier.org.uk. Terry Sanderson, our atheist guest and leading UK secularist, who's having a chat today about these rights and how we establish what is and isn't appropriate in a fair society. So come back again in a short moment's time for the second part of today's programme.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. My guest on the programme today here in the studio, Os Guinness, author, social critic, and most recently he's been working on what's called the Global Charter of Conscience, a way to allow people of all different worldviews to come to the table and live with their deepest differences. That's the aim of the Charter. It's, in a sense, a reaffirmation, a new way of looking at the Declaration of Human Rights. And Terry Sanderson of the National Secular Society is interacting with us on this question today about how we can come to make sure everyone gets a fair hearing. So we've been talking, Terry, in the context of particular cases, which have obviously created a lot of media attention in the last year or two, the bed and breakfast owners who were prosecuted for not allowing two gay men to share a bedroom. Lots of people painted this as a case of human rights versus people's religious rights. You've already said human rights will always trump, as far as you're concerned, religious rights. Oz says, well, religious rights are a human right. Let's not, you know, distinguish them necessarily in that way. But you're saying that too often Christians and people of faith want their religious rights to step too far into the personal lives of people who don't share them.
Yes, I think we have to decide how far religious rights do extend. I mean, if religious rights mean the rights to gather, to worship, and to hold a religious belief and to practice that religious belief, then that is a given. Everybody would accept that.
Would you add the share it?
Yes, absolutely. You'd to share that, it well, in would community.
Would you add, as Article 18 does, the ability to change it?
Yes,
you
absolutely.
Would. Okay.
Yeah, I'm all for religious mm-hmm. freedom, but I want to define what religious freedom means between you and me, because I think I have a different idea of how far religious freedom extends or what the limits of its definition are. And I think once it comes out of church, out of your home, it begins immediately, particularly proselytizing religions like Christianity and Islam. It immediately begins to have this desire to bring other people under its ambit. And at the moment, in America, for instance, you have the Catholic Church just having launched a fortnight for freedom, as they call it, whereby they're trying to persuade the government to, in effect, write Catholic doctrine into law about contraception.
No, they're not. Absolutely.
Yes, they are. They are.
Terry, you really don't understand that situation. I'm sorry.
Yes,
I've been
I do.
Close to that. I've been in the White House for discussions and that. What you're saying is dead wrong.
No, it isn't. I think that you can say it's dead wrong, but in fact, if you look closely at what's been happening in America
with this Catholic campaign,
you'll see that there's a very political motivation there.
I agree with that, but they're not
a very political pressure to actually get the government to change its policy on contraception, a policy that was democratically arrived at.
No.
Now that to me seems to be an extension of religious freedom too far.
Terry, you're not describing the situation rightly at all.
Tell me where I'm wrong.
The Catholic Church was being asked to provide services of abortion and contraception. I'm not a Catholic. But they were asked to provide services that on the dictates of their conscience were fundamentally opposed to their moral convictions. They were not trying to write anything into law. There was a new law.
They weren't being required to provide them. They were they were asked to provide the insurance.
No, that was the compromise.
The compromise was that they would not have to pay that part.
Well, let's just for those who are perhaps on this side of the pond are not familiar with this case. I've heard about it, but
he's got the facts of the case badly wrong.
Give us your version of the facts, Oz, and we'll allow Terry.
Well, the bottom line is the Catholics were asked to do something that was against their moral conscience. I'm not a Catholic. I don't disagree with contraception, but they do. No one should be asked to do something against what is their conviction based on moral conscience. That was the issue.
This was in a medical context, was it?
Healthcare,
healthcare. And mm-hmm. now...
And it was a deliberate...
Is the problem that these are in some way publicly funded hospitals?
No, these are Catholic hospitals.
Okay, so
these are Catholic hospitals. And it was a policy put forward, let's be blunt about it, because it's well known. I was in the White House discussing some of this by the so-called LGBT coalition, which the president supported. Well, he's welcome to, but he happened to be opposing conscience, and that's maybe the first time that any American administration has done that so bluntly. So the situation wasn't quite what you're describing. But let's go back to your point, Terry. I'd put it like this. You're right that sometimes people want to do things in the practice of their faith that stands on other people's toes. Take, say, the wearing of a cross. If you have... I see religious freedom like an accordion. you can flatten an accordion, won't play any music, but still an accordion. And that's kind of restricting religious freedom to worship only. But if you bring it out to practice, sharing, changing, and all the various things, and you have, and the charter talks a lot about civility. And remember, this isn't just for Christians, this is everyone, including you. If you have a high civility, we're not going to get upset as someone comes into the office wearing a cross. Many of the things today don't need to go to law, and an ounce of civility would solve what a ton of legal action will never solve. And the problem is we don't have the trust at the moment, you know, between us all as to how to further everybody's interests. So I'm not arguing here as a Christian. I am a Christian. You know that. I'm quite clear about that. I'm arguing for the common good, yours as well as mine.
Yeah, I'm all for civility, and I hope this is a civil conversation, although it may get a bit heated. The idea that people cannot negotiate the wearing of crosses in the workplace is absolutely not true. The cases that have come to court have been very specifically about issues to do with uniform and health and safety. They're not to do with there being some sort of ban on crosses at work. And I know loads and loads of people who wear crosses at work and with no problem whatsoever. So this is not really about restrictions in that sort of way.
Well,
it's about when people bring their religion out of church, which they're entitled to do, and to try to persuade other people to share that religion. But then it starts to become a bit authoritarian and bossy, you know, and people start to challenge you because you will not share what they want you to believe and which they believe passionately.
Well, as soon as they become bossy and authoritarian, in your words, that's terrible. That's wrong. And I would oppose that strongly along with you. In other words, a free, open public square assumes one thing, the ability to persuade. You're absolutely right. Any bossy authoritarianism, I agree with you, that's bad.
What about not just that sort of, as it were, passive issue in the workplace of can I wear a cross? But there have been these cases as well of doctors and nurses who have been disciplined or worse for sharing their faith in some way with a patient, perhaps offering to pray. Terry, what's the line for you on this? Is it okay for in a workplace environment, say a doctor doing a GP's call, offering to pray for a patient? Would that overstep the line for you of interfering with someone else's personal rights not to have to encounter that kind of thing in the capacity of a doctor-patient relationship?
It would all depend on the circumstances. I think that if the patient initiates that conversation, I would have no objection whatsoever. But I would feel very strongly that a doctor shouldn't initiate a conversation like that if he's in a situation of treatment. There was a case of the nurse who was a district nurse and went into people's homes to do things like treating wounds and making sure they didn't get bed sores and things like that. And she started to ask them if they wanted to pray with her. Now, that was, as far as I'm concerned, an abuse of the privilege she had of going into their homes to do something very specific, which was not praying. And I think it's you have to be very careful when you're in a position of power and privilege like that in people's lives, that you don't misuse it. And particularly with religion, which can be, as we saw in the case of Dr. Scott a couple of weeks ago, which can cause distress to people and cause them to become very anxious and to start complaining about it. So it's very difficult.
What's your reaction to those sorts of issues?
Well, no, I broadly agree with Terry on that. There are times when it's thoroughly inappropriate and thoroughly intrusive. But many of these situations, here's another point taken in a different area. The great Alexis de Tocqueville, a French commentator, pointed out that freedom is kept best not by law, but by the habits of the heart, as he called it. And I would argue, and the Charter would argue, if you recreate civility and trust between us, like we're doing on the program here, you know, you do that, you can work it out in the different situations. So he said, Terry rightly said, it depends on the circumstances. And we need people with a much deeper understanding when it's appropriate and when it's not. For instance, I'm a follower of Jesus. I think the public square, when we're talking about issues of public life, that's not the place to argue for the Christian faith itself. And if you do that in the public square, it often gets very, very ugly and controversial. I think that's much better left in the private sphere. But I still like the freedom to be able to argue that something that comes from the Christian perspective, and to be free into doing that. So his point about the circumstances is absolutely right. And civility, or the habits of the heart, they cover a lot of these things, and many of our current disputes are unnecessary. That's the trouble. We've become increasingly litigious.
Mm. How do you cope when people will not obey the rules? When you have, for instance, a body that governs a profession that has written rules saying, you know, as the doctor's governing body does, to say you will not proselytize as part of your duties. You can certainly discuss spiritual matters if it's appropriate, but proselytizing is not appropriate.
But some,
and if Terry, someone try to do that, then somebody's got to say, look, this is a divide. This is the line in the sand. Do not cross it.
Yeah, but two things. On the one hand, in the present culture wars climate, both sides want to cross the lines and put it on the nose of the other side. That's one unfortunate problem, because there's so little trust and so little civility today. The other thing is, as you know well, there have been cases of real deception, say of journalists pretending to be people who wanted counsel on this and that, and then later coming out of the closet and saying who they were and suing the people. Well, some of those were extremely unfortunate and quite unnecessary if they'd acted with real integrity. In other words, they were deceptive. I don't know, you surely wouldn't support that.
Well, again, it would depend on the circumstances. It would depend on how much damage was being done by the person being exposed. And if they were genuinely hurting other people, then I think it would be legitimate to expose them in any way.
Yes, certainly. Anyone hurting with anyone should be exposed. But in many of the cases, they weren't.
I mean, what strikes me is how we define what is the public square, what is the private sphere that you've already mentioned there. I mean, you talk, Terry, about wanting religion to essentially be a private matter, but religion, you know, Christianity lived out, will never be purely private.
Will any faith.
No, I mean, that's right. But I think, for instance,
Terry, let's be clear, you're not saying you want it to be purely private, are you?
No, not private in the sense that
restricted,
that individuals can't express themselves. Mm-hmm. For instance, in Parliament, which I suppose is the ultimate public square, we have Christian MPs who have been elected democratically, and best of luck to them, who say, I'm speaking from a Christian perspective when I'm voting on this matter or debating this matter. And for instance, in the present debate about gay marriage, which is going on in this country, we have lots of MPs in Parliament who are saying, you know, I'm speaking as a Christian when I oppose this. And I say, well, that's good, because, you know, you have been elected and you're there legitimately. But if for instance, the Catholic Church or the Church of England comes along as a body and tries to influence that in ways that are not just sort of ordinary lobbying that anybody can do, but that are using special privileges, and certainly the Church of England has privileges in the political life of this country, that's when I start to worry about it, and that's when secularism would kick in for me, because we would not have a church with special privileges and access to the government.
Well, you know, the Charter doesn't argue for any particular settlement. What it argues, and certainly what I argue for, is that any country with its own history and background is free to choose its system, and England still, for the moment, has a state church, the Church of England. But we're just arguing that within whatever settlement any country has, you expand the spheres of freedom for everybody and create a mounting civility. Now, personally, I think this is nothing to do with the Charter. I think the American situation at its best, which is not today's situation, has a better way. I personally support disestablishment, because what it does is make religion voluntary. And I think the Christian and the Jewish faiths, at their heart, God never wants coerced belief. You have a free, voluntary, independent belief, and that's it. But that's my personal position. That's not the Charter's.
Yeah, the one other aspect of the Charter which was a bit disappointing was that it doesn't spend a great deal of time talking about democracy. And I think this is one of the things that is absolutely essential to make secularism work. You do talk in the Charter about secular despots who've been as oppressive as any theocracy. And I agree that there have been people who tried to enforce secular ways of lives, like the old Soviet Union, and a lot of the despots who've been deposed in the Middle East recently were also secular in the sense that they tried to keep religion under wraps and under control. But, you know, democracy is an absolute essential partner to secularism. It has to be freely chosen. It has to be the will of the people.
I agree with what you're saying totally. But the Charter is only a reaffirmation of Article 18. And it sticks to that last, which I think is actually a very, very key part of going forward in the whole world, because living with our deep differences is one of the huge questions for humanity. So I happen to be strongly in favor of democracy too, but that wasn't the point of Article 18.
No, but it's one of the ways that we can, one of the tools we can use, if you like, to define religion's place in society.
I couldn't agree more.
Once religion is in charge, there is no more democracy. I think if everybody's going to have an equal voice, which is your ambition, then we need democracy and we need secularism.
We do, Let's go back to the definition again, because secularism and secularization, say, are quite different.
No, absolutely.
And even someone, an atheist like Jürgen Habermas, talks about our being in a post-secularist world. So there's a lot of fuzzy talk, and you and I could sit down and talk for quite a while about that. Secularism, as I'm using the word, and maybe you disagree with this too, secularism, ending in ISM, is a belief that there's no such thing as God, gods, and the supernatural.
No, I wouldn't agree with that.
How would you define it, just very simply?
It's a political system that separates religion from the state, and that the two are two separate domains. That is all. It's an overarching political structure that helps democracy give everybody a fair shot.
Oh, well, then, all right, I understand your definition here. Then we've got a choice between different ways of doing that. You've got mild versions of that, and the American one is very different, say, from the French, and the French is relatively mild compared, say, with the Chinese. Now, you're surely not advocating something like China's draconian version.
Well, I wouldn't say that China was a democratic nation.
No, but it's a secularist.
No, it's a despotism.
All right,
it's
a secularist despotism.
Yeah, absolutely. The kind of secularism that I am advocating has to go hand in hand with democracy.
What you're really talking about, though, if I understand it, is more what the Americans call separationist.
Yeah.
But that isn't necessarily, in other words, Tocqueville points out that despite disestablishment, but actually because of it, religion has flourished in America better than any other modern country, because the separation of church and state is institutional, and I agree with that, but it doesn't separate faith and public life.
No, that's true, and I don't think the French model does either.
Well, the Muslims are...
It certainly says that everybody is an equal citizen, but they're a French citizen first, and they're not Muslim citizens or Christian citizens. They're citizens of the Republic, and if everybody agrees, is a good system to live by.
Actually,
because you're then free to follow your own conscience in your own way, but you cannot tell the state that the state should operate according to your conscience.
But none of us are telling that. No, none of us are doing that. Don't put it like that, Terry. All we're arguing for, this is part of the Charter, that everyone's free from whatever position to go in, and they've got to argue their position. And they, if they want the quote, state to take their position, they've got to have 51% through Parliament or whatever. In other words, each individual have to be persuasive. No one today can coerce anyone. You have to be persuasive. You wouldn't disagree with that, would you?
Well, when you say nobody can coerce anyone, I think that maybe they can. There are some people who've certainly got more power than other people. And I think that we can't have a totally egalitarian society, but we can have a society where everybody starts off equally. And what they make of that freedom is up to them. But that there has to be limits on what any one theology or ideology can inflict on everybody else.
And that's the importance of minority rights, which are absolutely inalienable and inviolable. And the Charter is extremely clear on that. You've got to have minority rights.
I mean, the big talking issue at the moment, as you've rightly said, Terry, is the gay marriage issue. We did a programme on that not so long ago on this programme, and so I'm not interested in necessarily running through all the arguments for and against again. But, I mean, recently the Church of England expressed concerns that because of its institutional nature, churches could well be required to undertake gay marriage ceremonies, even when they are personally opposed to it. There is sometimes a ramification for people's personal religious views coming into conflict with potentially this law that is set to be passed here in this country. So do you see that they have a point there, or is that simply another argument for disestablishing the Church of England in some way?
Yeah, I think actually the government has promised them that they will not have to conduct gay marriages in their places of worship. So they obviously don't accept that. They say that will quickly be undermined by the European Court of Human Rights. But I don't think it will be. But that's a different argument, as you say. But it does illustrate the weakness and the flaws in having an established church, because when the church and the state come into conflict, as they are over this issue, the church is obviously trying to make the government do what it wants. And that's when I start to think, you know, that
but in
this
a sense,
is when religion
does
overstepping the line.
The church makes the government. I mean, what Oz is arguing for is that the church should have a voice. We shouldn't stop the church putting its point of view to the government. But are you saying that it has an unfair advantage because of this institutionalised nature?
Yeah, because it is part of the state. It's established by law. If other religious bodies have to lobby, like we do, the National Secular Society lobbies, but we have to do it on a level playing field with everybody else. The Church of England has a very special status within the state to turn the screws on the government.
Mm-hmm. No, and personally, and this has nothing again to do with the Charter, it's my personal opinion, the Church of England has a huge number of contradictions it's facing today, because it is, put it bluntly, it is spiritually and culturally extremely weak. And so it doesn't have the position even to try to do what you're saying. So I have a lot of sympathy for what you're saying there. But that's nothing to do with the Charter. The Charter's a vision of public life that opens the door for people.
I suppose that the danger is that some people do feel that in this whole gay marriage debate that's been going on in this country, Oz, and I'm sure you've been aware of some aspects of it.
Oh, it started in the US first.
Well absolutely. that it's almost become, it's very much looking like the government are saying this is going to happen whether you like it or not. There isn't actually a discussion to be happening here on this. So some people feel that there is already an agenda at work and no one's, other voices are actually being listened to. But secondly, that if you do raise a voice against it, you're immediately labelled bigot. Mm-hmm. You know, there are these cases of a law conference on the issue being sort of chucked out of the conference centre that they were done as soon as it was discovered what the nature of the thing was. I mean, is this kind of the types of issues that the charter is aimed at addressing, how we can have the conversation?
This is an incredibly important issue. But the trouble is, in the incivility, which would be a mild word to describe it, all these issues become highly inflammatory immediately. And that's the problem. You know, so I tell my fellow Christians in the U.S., if we enter the public debate arguing for a traditional marriage, one man, one woman, we can't just say, I'm a Christian, or the Bible says. That isn't persuasive. We've got to know how to make arguments to people in terms of sociology, anthropology, civilizations, and so on. In other words, to be persuasive. And that's great Christians like Wilberforce. For 20 years, put it in boxing terms, he was beaten on points year after year after year after year, until he learned to be powerfully persuasive and then won the argument and slavery was knocked out. Christians need to be persuasive. The other point coming in, and this is to the other side, it's awful when the right of conscientious objection is not recognized. Now, we still recognize it in terms of warfare, but it's extraordinary that since freedom of conscience was the first thing established, that doctors are not given that right today when it comes to, say, or abortion or whatever it is, and soon it'll be euthanasia. We need to be absolutely clear that freedom of conscience and conscientious objection is fundamental in a free society.
We're going to have to take another quick break. We're going to finish off this conversation between my guests today, Oz Guinness and Terry Sanderson, in a short moment's time. Here on the show that aims to get you thinking, Unbelievable, with me, Justin Brierley. Welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Justin Brierley, and we'll be hearing your feedback in a few minutes' time after we hear the final summing up from Oz Guinness and Terry Sanderson on today's topic, looking at Oz Guinness's Global Charter of Conscience. Before we get to that, let me say, if you're tuning in next week between 2:30 and 4, something that I've wanted to do for ages, and just getting around to it, 6.5 years into the show, a Jehovah's Witness show. We're going to be hearing from Robert King. Now, he is a Jehovah's Witness in the sense that he holds all the main doctrines of the Jehovah's Witnesses. He has, in fact, been disfellowshipped. And I suspect it would be very difficult to get a Jehovah's Witness who is still in fellowship with the Watchtower Society. And so that's the reason Robert is coming on the line from the States. However, he will be representing, as it were, the main doctrines of the Jehovah's Witnesses. And he's going to be in conversation with a former Jehovah's Witness, now a Christian, Tony Brown. So if you'd like to listen in to that, same time next week, and we're actually going to do two shows with these guys, starting off next week with an examination of the history of the Jehovah's Witnesses, the prophecies, did they fail? Are they a cult? Which is a sort of somewhat controversial question, depending on what your definition is of a cult. Peculiar doctrines about blood. What about the Watchtower organization itself? And that's kind of where we'll be starting, and then doing a follow-up show on one of the key differences between mainline Christianity and Jehovah's Witnesses, their view of Jesus and the Trinity and Scripture. So I hope you can come back for that if you're interested in those kinds of issues. And we'll be going to be following up those two episodes with a Jehovah's Witness with episodes with a Mormon, which again will have a whole lot of interesting aspects to it, I'm sure. So come back for that at the same time next week. Right now, let's finish up today's programme.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, concluding today's programme, and my guests Oz Guinness and Terry Sanderson have been with me, Making a Fair Society, Can Christians and Secularists Work Together So Everyone Gets Heard? We've been looking at, in some detail, at the Global Charter of Conscience, as authored by Oz and a number of others, and that was presented recently in a lecture here in London for Premier Christian Radio. You can hear Oz's lecture tomorrow evening, Sunday the 1st of July at 9 p.m. But if you're listening at a later date on the podcast of this programme, you can always find it online at premier.org.uk. Indeed, I'll add a link to the podcast as and when it's available. Oz, I found you and Terry agreeing actually on quite a lot, and perhaps Terry would say, you know, in its best form, secularism does what you want it to do. It gives everyone a fair voice, but makes sure that the playing field is level, so that no voice has, in that sense, are you saying anything radically different to what Terry ultimately wants here?
Well, I don't know Terry well enough to know where we disagree and where we'd agree, and I've certainly enjoyed meeting him by phone. But in terms of the public argument today, we've got strident religious voices, and on the other side, maybe Terry would agree, we've got strident atheist voices. And one of the features of the so-called new atheists, like Dawkins, Harris, Hitchens, and so on, is their attacks on moderation. For instance, Sam Harris says that religious moderates are the problem because they tolerate religious extremists. So you've got to get rid of moderates too. I mean, it's extremely radical stuff. And it's that sort of a voice that's blocking people of all faiths entering public life. And I would hope Terry would agree with that. If he's someone who argues for freedom for everybody on equal terms to enter and engage, that's all we're talking about. You said we looked at the charter in detail. Well, we've actually discussed one article of 29.
Yes, indeed. That was a bit of an overstatement on my part. Terry, fundamentally, you had some worries about certain wording in the charter, but it sounded like overall, it was not far off the aims of what you consider secularism to be aiming at.
Well, I did show the charter to the other councillor management members of the NSS to get some input from them about what they thought about it, because I was quite impressed at first reading. But when they read through it, they began to feel a little bit suspicious about the motivation of the people who'd written it. And certainly I had reports of the launch of it in the European Parliament that said that there were some very... what we would call suspect religious organisations in attendance.
Can you be specific?
Well, the Alliance Defence Fund of Arizona, for instance, who have a presence in the European Parliament, which we think is not healthy.
For what it's worth, I would often think some of their contributions are extremist.
Yeah.
Their part, I had no idea they were there. But of the spokesman there, you had secularist voices, Christian voices. You didn't have anyone irresponsible extremist. And believe me, I've had death threats from Christian extremists. I am against them because they're politically wrong, but they're also sub-Christian. Let me be absolutely clear. So I'm as against Christian extremism as anyone. So suspicion's a good word. We don't know each other well enough, but I hope if you did, you'd be able to trust me on that.
Yeah, well, I hope so. And as it stands at the moment, I would like to go through this charter clause by clause with you to talk about it in detail and find out what the thinking is behind it.
Mm-hmm.
and how you've reached the conclusions that you have, because at the moment, as it stands, the NSS wouldn't be able to sign up to it. There are too many what are regarded as holes in the thinking that we would like to have explained. But any attempt to bring understanding between people who are at loggerheads has got to be worth trying.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not entirely against what you're trying to do, but I think this has to be a work in progress.
Absolutely. And I hope we can talk and others can talk over the months and the years and develop trust, which is a very key part of civility. Because the point is to be able to get to the place where we can disagree radically at certain points and yet do so with trust.
And I hope this program in some way helps to facilitate that ongoing conversation. And who knows, perhaps this will carry on beyond the studio at some level. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for both being here.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
It's been a really interesting discussion today, and I hope you've enjoyed listening. If you'd like to get in touch with your thoughts on it, and indeed to see the charter, read it for yourself, then do get in touch. We'll certainly make the website where you can get hold of it available, and all the rest of it, with the podcast of today's program. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable if you'd like to read the charter for yourself and some of the frequently asked questions about it. Do listen to Oz presenting on it tomorrow evening at 9 o'clock, if you're listening this Saturday when the program's going out. But if you're listening via the podcast, it'll also be online, so premier.org.uk to find out more about that. Your thoughts welcome to the email address unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and we're going to be hearing some of your reactions to the last few weeks of programming in just a moment's time. In the meantime, thanks Oz for being with me, and thank you Terry as well, and thank you for listening.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I look forward to getting your emails and your phone voicemails and all that sort of thing. Don't forget, as ever, you can follow us at UnbelievableJB. We're on Twitter. Also, the same sort of address for Facebook, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB, where you can find the page of the show, which I update pretty regularly. And there's also a group, which is kind of more aimed at long-running discussions, debates between people online who listen to the show. So lots of atheists and Christians contribute there. As I say, next week, moving away from the atheist Christian discussions for a little while, as we look at Jehovah's Witnesses and follow that up with some shows with a Mormon listener to this show. So I'm very excited about that. Let's look at some of your feedback, though, to the last few weeks of programming. Last week, we aired that debate that took place between atheist biologist Lewis Wolpert and Christian astrophysicist Hugh Ross, who, of course, was a guest with me here at Unbelievable, the conference just over a month ago. And they took part in this debate at Imperial College in London on whether there's evidence for a cosmic creator. Bill wanted to get in touch to say thanks for another thought-provoking programme. I thought Lewis Wolpert's arguments were poor. I don't understand the physics, so I'm not accepting that evidence. What would the reaction be if a Christian had the same approach? His argument that absence of evidence is evidence of absence would also seem a bit flawed. 300 years ago, all swans were white. There was no evidence for swans of any other colour. So, following Lewis Wolpert's argument, there weren't any swans of any other colour. Then we went to Australia and discovered black swans. I thought Hugh Ross made one mistake, though. He was asked for evidence for God. The best evidence for God is the life, death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Looking forward to next week's programme. I hope you enjoyed this week's programme then, Bill. Obviously, in the context of the programme and indeed Hugh's expertise, we were doing a discussion on whether there's evidence for God from the universe, from the cosmos, as it were, which was obviously where the arguments focused, therefore, when he was asked for his best piece of evidence by Lewis Wolpert. It was obviously in the context of what he'd presented to start with. But I totally appreciate that. And thanks to those who've been in touch with their best piece of evidence for God in order to win one of these free audiobook downloads of A Matter of Days by Hugh Ross that I was mentioning on last week's show. Still a chance to get your name as well in that draw for 10 of those. And you can get yourself a free download of the audiobook by Hugh Ross if you email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. What's your best evidence for God? And I'll pick the names out of a hat and send those cards on with the special codes for the free download. Now, going back to the week before, and again, it was Hugh Ross, this time teaming up with Ken Samples of Reasons to Believe. They were opposite Andy McIntosh and Stephen Lloyd, young Earth creationists, as they debated the age of the Earth. Ken and Hugh holding to an old Earth perspective on that issue. Well, Fred wanted to get in touch from Canada. He says this post is written in humble spirit and from a layman who's certainly not qualified to enter into a detailed debate with any of the folks from Reasons to Believe. As such, my comments are brief. What struck me from all in the discussion was, one, these gentlemen are brilliant and take great pride in campaigning for Christ. For this, they have my tremendous respect. Two, the derivations from many of the proposed models to establish the age of the Earth is almost mind-boggling. In my best Carl Sagan voice, I say that it must be very difficult to rely on calculations that include billions and billions of years. What kind of deviation would cause these models to go from well-supported to irrelevant? My guess is not much. The more that I learn about science, which admittedly is pretty minuscule, the more I understand how much we know about how little we know. What I also understand is how little some scientists appreciate how little that they do actually know. The distance that some travel from the humility of how little we know about God's glory seems to travel in direct proportion to their knowledge of science and nature. I guess what I'm driving at is that I think it's dangerous, nay folly, to be dogmatic about something as difficult to establish as the age of the earth. I think that there are many other examples of where we try to elucidate on portions of scripture that we're simply not equipped to elucidate upon. Though I have tremendous respect for the Christian spirit of Dr. Ross et al., I must submit that I am not convinced that having debates over the age of the earth could be considered a ministry. I simply do not think that the facts are clear, and the debate from the young earth creationists helped to highlight this fact. It seemed as if there was a lot at stake by winning or losing the debate, when in the end there was nothing at stake at all. Similarly, we can debate endlessly over once saved, always saved, infant baptism, annihilationism versus eternal judgment, etc. In the end, I think we have our hands full focusing on Christ and living out the commands that he gave us. Thank you very much, Fred. I think the way that Hugh Ross and Ken Samples would see it, as far as the importance of bringing, as it were, a defence of the old earth view, is that it lends a credibility to the Christian endeavour, to apologetics, which is otherwise lacking in their view if we go for a simply young earth creationist view. And that is important in, you know, what is essentially the task of apologetics, persuading people. In fact, they told me a number of stories of people, Christians, for whom once they had discovered their interpretation, their old earth creationist view, it was like the scales dropping from their eyes, as it were, and their ability to then go and be confident in their faith from that point on was transformed in many ways. But obviously, there is a strong young earth view out there which would probably say exactly the same thing in the opposite direction. I acknowledge that. Quinn in Florida on that says, just finished listening to that podcast on old versus young earth. On the merits, I think Stephen Lloyd, the young earth creationist, was the most persuasive presenter. And I'm an old earther. He's right to call out Hugh Ross on his hermeneutics, namely reading current science back into the Bible, mistaking the meanings of laws and the like. I myself hold to the framework view of Genesis 1, which says in essence that the passage is an exalted prose narrative, not quite poetry, and should not be read as a play-by-play account of God creating the world. In my view, both standard young earth creationists like your debater Andy McIntosh and old earth creationists like Ross make this mistake, and by misjudging the genre of this passage, they misinterpret its claims and implications. Sorry, I can't read all of what you had to say on that, Quinn, because you sent on another one after that, which I'll read a little of. I'll go out on a limb, you say, and suggest that young earth creationism is fundamentally compatible with the theory of biological and galactic evolution. Now, you make an interesting case here for the idea that if you were to take a young earth creation reading, that everything had been created with the look of being aged, mature, you could go on to say, presumably by comparison, that the specially created wine at the wedding at Cana in John 2 appears to be a fine aged wine, having just been created. Presumably the wedding attendees did not know the difference in that act of divine transubstantiation. Well, if one grants the indistinguishability of actual age and the appearance of age in God's special acts of creation, as young earth creationists do, then one could accept development from simple to complex as an accurate theory to summarise the fossil record. Because that is simply, I think the implication is that if Adam looked at the rings of a tree, he would be perfectly justified in surmising that it had been there thousands of years, even if it hadn't. And so you go on to say, if I'm reading this correctly, and apologies because I am sort of trying to boil it down here, recognising galactical and biological evolution in conjunction with the appearance of age thus doesn't require one to believe God actually made the universe by means of that long-term evolution, just that he built it with maturity and the appearance that he did. One could still hold that God created all things in a 24-hour, 7-day period, but that he built the world in media res to look like the means of his creation was millions of years of development from stardust to humans. Hence, young earth creationism and evolution are not inherently incompatible. Problem solved. You're welcome, says Quinn. Yes. I don't know. does God deceive? I mean, if it looks old, would God really have made it look old, even though it's not old, and confuses us a bit with telling us that it isn't old in the Bible and yet it looking old according to science? Well, that was what we were debating, obviously. Okay, let's go to a lovely letter I was handed at that Young Earth, Old Earth creationist debate, which happened just a couple of days after Unbelievable, the conference 2012. It was from someone who had come along having heard about the debate at the conference a few days earlier. And he wrote this, David Taylor. So I very rarely get letters actually written down. Literally from his own hand, this. So thank you, David, for taking the time. Dear Justin, thanks so much for the excellent apologetics conference at Transformation House last Saturday. You had an excellent lineup of speakers, and each session that I attended was first rate. I was particularly pleased to hear Hugh Ross. I read one of his books about 15 years ago and realised that there was a great deal more than I needed to look into as a result of reading it. But until last Saturday, I had not followed up on it. Michael Green was a breath of fresh air too. And this new venue was, as you said, absolutely superb and very accessible, being so close to Britain's busiest railway station. I should try to encourage more people to come along from my church to the next one. Might it be worth making a 1 or 2 minute promotional trailer to show during the church adverts? Perhaps it could be added to the front of the DVD that you are producing. Thank you for the huge amount of work that you and many others put into making such a helpful and smooth-running day. I enjoy your programmes on Saturday afternoons too. Thank you very much, David. I really appreciated that note, one of many that I've received in regard to the conference. We did actually produce a short trailer. Whether churches used it to project, I'm not sure, but we can certainly try and do more to encourage churches to do that with the next one. We won't quite be in a position to announce the details of the next conference with this DVD, but we'll certainly be doing it as we did this time, a bit of a social media campaign to raise awareness of it closer to the time of the conference. So glad you enjoyed it so much, though, David. Thank you for writing. And so if you want to get hold of the DVD, let me remind you that you can get hold of it by going to the website and ordering it. Three DVDs, just about 10 hours worth of material from all the speakers that were at Unbelievable, the conference 2012, earlier in the year, just a month or so ago. premier.org.uk/DVD. Again, premier.org.uk/DVD if you'd like to get hold of the three-disc DVD. And you're welcome to do that. Be good to hear what you make of it. And I'd like to hear what you made of today's programme as well. Don't forget, you can always email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, to let me know what you thought. Well, ranging a bit wider, we've had a couple of phone messages in. Going to play these out. Let's hear what these people had to say.
Hi, Justin. I've just got finished listening to the podcast of the show with Mike Lee and David Robertson. And it was fantastic. I actually started feeling a little bit sorry for Mike Lee, because they just didn't seem to be in the same league of debating. Every single point you came up with, David came back with something that clearly put down, defeated his point. And it's great to have David back, and I'm glad he's better. And I look forward to hearing him more on the show, and more of that, and more of the same is brilliant. Thanks. Bye.
My name is Anthony Weston. I enjoy Unbelievable very much. I do myself lecture in Christian apologetics at a college-type course in Cumbran. My one comment, apart from saying thank you, thank you, thank you, for Unbelievable, is to say this: one area that seems to me to be undeveloped by Christian apologetics is the amount of evidence there is for the resurrection of Christ from first century history. It's sometimes suggested, and I cannot understand why so frequently suggested, that there is damagingly little new contemporary evidence for Christ's resurrection. To my mind, this is simply not the case, and this is an area that could be explored more fully than it is. Thank you very much and God bless you.
Well, thank you very much both for those phone messages. We're out of time and I had so many more emails here to look at regarding other programmes that we've had on not so long ago. So we'll have to come to those another time, I'm afraid. For the moment, thank you very much for listening today. I hope you enjoyed today's programme. Again, if you want to hear Os Guinness talking about the Global Charter of Conscience, the lecture is on tomorrow evening, Sunday at 9 p.m. on Premier Christian Radio. Go to Unbelievable's webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, for links to where you can find the text of the charter, links to programmes and audio, Oz's lecture, etc., that are tied in with that. It's a campaign that Premier are supporting. So thank you very much for listening today. Coming up next week, as I mentioned, I'm very excited about next week's show. We're doing the Jehovah's Witnesses.
You're unbelievable.
And my guest for next week's show is Robert King, who is out in the States. He is, or was at least, a Jehovah's Witness. He still holds to all the core doctrines of the Jehovah's Witnesses, but he has been disfellowshipped. So in that sense, we're not saying here that Robert is representing the Jehovah's Witnesses in any official capacity. But we'll find out why he was disfellowshipped, why he still nevertheless holds to core teachings of the Jehovah's Witnesses. And in that respect, he'll be in conversation with Tony Brown, a former Jehovah's Witness himself, now a Christian, with a ministry to Jehovah's Witnesses. And we'll be examining the history of the religion, the prophecies, some may say failed prophecies, of the Jehovah's Witnesses, whether they are a cult, the blood doctrines, the Watchtower organization, and other things besides, before we go on to a follow-up program to that, looking at some of the key distinctives regarding their rejection of the Trinity, the deity of Jesus, their use of scripture, the New World Translation they use, and that sort of thing. So hope you can come back for that at the same time next week, 2:30 till 4 p.m. here on Premier Christian Radio, for what promises to be really interesting dialogue. And don't forget, we're online as well if you can't catch us on a Saturday, at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Until then, I've been Justin Brierley, and I hope you have a great week to come.